Hey, this is Sam Seder. You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio. Hi, I'm Sam Seder.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Ken Klippenstein, investigative reporter at The Intercept, will join us to discuss the fallout from the failed Capitol insurrection in terms of our national security and law enforcement agencies, as well as a potential expansion of indiscriminate terrorism laws to domestic terrorists and why that's problematic.
And Heather Digby Parton will join us to discuss the biggest news stories of the week. Become a member of this podcast over at ROFpodcast.com. Hey, it's your support that helps keep this show going. Don't forget, you can watch the interviews from the Ring of Fire podcast on the Majority Report YouTube channel. Head over to youtube.com/Sam Seder. Here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon, and of course, the Uber blog, Hullabaloo. So, Heather, been a sort of a, to a certain extent, we have these two major stories that are in many ways running in parallel with each other, and that is the COVID relief bill and impeachment. And both these stories reveal something about the Republicans. The stories, in some respects, are at odds with each other in terms of what it's revealing about the Democrats. There's a fascinating dynamic that's starting to emerge within both parties, in that there was a nascent split in the Republican Party, which seems to be just all but mended up. we should talk about that. And then there seems to be a burgeoning split in the Democratic Party, and the lines are not as I would have necessarily predicted them. But why don't we start with the Republican Party? Because something interesting happened, as far as I can tell, this week, maybe over the past week, week and a half, which was we are now 20 some odd days out, 22 days out from the insurrection at the Capitol. And immediately following that, the Republicans, I'm talking about the Republican leadership, seemed at least somewhat united in their feeling that Donald Trump was to blame. Mitch McConnell had announced to, or I should say privately leaked to the New York Times, that he was very happy that Donald Trump was going to be impeached. You had McCarthy, the Senate leader, the House leader, say that he felt Donald Trump inspired this insurrection. And now here we are a couple of weeks later. And to the extent that there was any attempt by the Republicans to sever their ties with Donald Trump, that seems to be over.
Yeah, it does seem to be over, but their problems aren't over. And they have an issue going on in the Republican Party that is going to be dogging them for some time. I think they've obviously decided, looking at the reaction among the grassroots. I mean, Mitch McConnell was challenged in Kentucky. He actually beat that challenge. They had some of the rabble rousers in the Republican Party down there want to censure him, and they beat that back, saying they didn't have standing. Arizona, they censured Cindy McCain, and they censured Jeff Flake and the governor, Steve Ducey, for failing to be properly, loyal to Donald Trump. Up in Oregon, they've got some QAnon stuff going on. So, and of course, they've got this, Liz Cheney, who sort of took the lead in the House of being the one to vote for impeachment and basically come down hard. We talked about this before. She made a bet that by the time 2024 rolls around, that anybody who opposed Trump is going to look good. She and Ben Sasse seem to have, you know, decided that was their future as Republican presidential aspirants. But she's getting a tremendous amount of blowback up there in Wyoming, and they are censuring her, and they're trying to remove in the House. They're trying to remove her from her leadership position, et cetera, et cetera. So there's been a lot of blowback over any attempt to separate from Donald Trump. And Mitch McConnell felt that. And I think that led him and many of the rest of the Republicans to do what they always do when this happens, just like after Access Hollywood or after the the first impeachment or anything else. This is their pattern. They always fall back into line. But there is a problem. There's new polling. And this is, you know, this is being borne out across the board. That, well, for instance, there's one here. Let's see. It was the Politico Morning Consult poll, which just came out this week. Over half of Republican voters, 56%, believe that Trump should either probably or definitely run for president again in 2024. 56%. That's a lot, but over a third, 36%, think he probably or definitely should not. Then there's this idea of having a third party. Their Republican and Republican-leaning independent voters are closely split between the Republican Party and the notional Patriot Party that Trump recently floated. A third said they're more interested in being a member of the Republicans, and 30% that said they'd be more interested in being a member of the third of the Patriot Party. So, you know, I mean, now in individual districts, this may not be a big problem. It's be mostly, you know, like in Marjorie Taylor Greene's district, she won by 50 points, right? So those are the kind of places where, you know, how no, you can't be too Trumpy. In fact, she's going even beyond Trump, I think. You know, you've got those QAnon congressional people. But this is a problem for Republicans on a national basis, and certainly in states where it's, you know, there's a close, you know, it's polarized, you know, closely. I mean, you see, look what happened in Arizona. Look what happened in Georgia. You know, Colorado used to be purple and you're, you know, be a swing state. And so they have got problems, and it's true. You know, I see what they're doing here. You know, they get this blowback, and these people are violent and they're horrible and they're threatening their families and they're doing all kinds of things, which, you know, you can see just on a sort of human level. They kind of go, OK, well, whatever. Be nice if they cared about democracy and, you know, the country and the Constitution. But, you know, this is where they're at. But they have got a problem. I mean, when they, if they're losing 36%. Saying that they don't want Donald Trump to run again. And they are out there basically, as far as I can tell, I mean, Kevin McCarthy was down there this week in Florida, basically there to, you know, make up and, you know, kiss the ring. You know, so I think they still have a problem. I think Mitch McConnell knows it and basically is hoping maybe that they can demonize the Democrats enough to make that 36% come back and vote for Donald Trump, even if they don't want to, assuming he runs again and, you know, wins re-election. But they're still Trumpifying the whole party, whether Trump's doing it himself or not.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I wonder, you know, Senator Rob Portman, I think it was this week, announced his more or less resignation. He's not going to run again. And I can't help but think that that is a function of that. And now, you know, like you mentioned, these 10 or 11 Republicans in the House who voted for impeachment, they those are going to be pickup opportunities for the Democrats, because those either they get primaried from the right and a absolute lunatic enters into those seats. And in some of those seats, they're not they could turn those districts into swing districts, frankly. Sure. And like you say, and this is what's fascinating about this to me is that I am not so surprised that the Republican Party is Trump's party, right? In terms of like the voting base, that doesn't surprise me. What was interesting, and I think what we had anticipated was that the Republicans were going to try and sever themselves from Donald Trump. And I was afraid that they would be able to do this. Not that their policies would be any different or anything like that, but just in the sort of public's eye, because certainly the media was willing to help that project in many respects, right? And in part, the media was willing to do that because Joe Biden was willing to do that, right? I mean, and Nancy Pelosi was willing to do this. They were all in the run up to the election, like, we need a Republican Party, and they weren't saying it in a sort of a theoretical sense. Joe Biden was on the record throughout the campaign: the fever will break. I don't think he used those exact words. I think that was more of the Obama words, but he was saying, wait till Donald Trump is gone. 6 months later, they're going to be fine. I mean, this is where these two stories sort of intersect, right? Because the real question ultimately is going to be, and this is coming on the heels of a vote, I guess that happened on Monday, where the entire Republican caucus, short of five people, tried to get the impeachment hearings tossed, ostensibly because of unity. the message that they're sending on impeachment, the real question is how much will Joe Biden and the Democrats, broadly speaking, pick that up when it comes to COVID relief? The idea that, like, hey, there's a negotiation to be had here and we can find something reasonable, because we're already starting to see that happen in the COVID thing. Now, there's some factors that could mitigate that and could explain that away as being less than sincere because, or at the very least, sort of a mulligan, because they have until early March. That's almost the time that they'll need to get a reconciliation bill sort of up on its feet and have the procedural systems set up and the bill itself sort of like okayed and made sure that it's viable against like the Byrd rule, which has to do with the deficit and has to do with proving that it's a government that everything in the bill will impact the budget, et cetera, et cetera. So the point being, on impeachment, the Republicans are telling a story, which is they are Donald Trump's party. They cannot, they have no wiggle room. And the question is, are the Democrats hearing that story when it comes to COVID relief? It seems to me.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think there's still, I mean, you can still see the sort of vestiges of, you know, some kind of delusion that this was all just kind of, this was a bad dream. It was like that, you know, that Dallas show where they woke up and the whole storyline was just somebody's dream. I mean, there's still that kind of attitude you can see in some places within the Democratic leadership, and even with Biden in some respects. I mean, you know, he said the other day that, well, I thought that the $2,000, I just assumed that because that had a strong bipartisan majority before in the House, that would be easy to pass. I just, you know, assumed we'd be able to do that. And I'm thinking, okay, you can say that, but I mean, of course, Donald Trump was president then. You do understand how this works, right? You know, when it's his idea, that's different than it is, you know, when it's yours. I mean, you have to understand that. And I don't know if he, you know, I mean, I have to assume he does get that, you know, I mean, whatever. But that's the sort of thing you sort of see swirling around in the Democratic discussions here. Now, again, it's just as you said, we don't know how much of this is positioning and, you know, negotiating stances and what have you. But the truth is, what you just said, the most important thing about this is they have no time for this. They don't have any time to deal with the, you know, the Nelson Cornhusker kickback or some other nonsense, even in the Republican, in the Democratic Party. You know, they're going to get that too. If they decide to go with reconciliation, we'll be back in that same situation where you're negotiating with the Democrats. Hopefully it won't be, you know, the way it was on Obamacare. This is a much less complicated, you know, issue. They're not building something from the ground up. This is just, you know, putting in place a bunch of policies to, you know, get checks to people and vaccinations to people. But the urgency, I mean, Mike, I can't even believe they're talking about March. Why? You know, I mean, to me, this is one where you give it a week. you know, and go, guys, you know, we have an emergency here. This is not something that we're just, we're not, this is not some program we're trying to put into place. This is emergency relief. So I'm a little confused by that and starting to get a little bit concerned because when I keep hearing things like March and, well, you know, that's when the eviction moratorium expires. I'm going, you know, it doesn't have to expire, actually. That's not really, you're making up deadlines here. And if you're going to do that, make the deadline February 15th. That's 2 weeks. And then you do it. You know, I don't, why March?
You know, I think usually they don't do anything until there is a drop dead deadline like that, right? Where they just barely, you know, miss by 2 days when something runs out. The other aspect of that is that the reconciliation process, it seems to me, my understanding is that you need to set up a couple of votes to set up the reconciliation. It's in and of itself. And I wonder if there isn't a sense that, well, we need to project this this notion that, you know, we're actually trying to put something together beforehand. I mean, I am, even if they are play acting with this whole unity thing, it scares me that they feel there's an audience for this play. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not clear. Like, even if this is pretense, which would make me happy, it scares me that they think they need to have pretense. Like, there's no audience for this that is meaningful in any way, as far as I can tell, particularly not 2 years out. And what was fascinating is that today, Thursday, there was a Senate caucus phone call, and apparently John Ossoff was very forceful on the phone call. We need to go big, and, you know, we need those $2,000 checks. And, you know, nibbling at the edges of, like, maybe we shouldn't make it available to people who are making $85,000 as opposed to 75 or 95, or maybe we should make it 1400 instead of 60, you know, instead of 2000. All of these things, and I think there's like some very narrow, weedy argument that, like, well, you'd want something that's a little bit more targeted and this and that. The bottom line is we're really talking about, A, we should be shoveling money and resources out the door in any way, almost like the vaccine, frankly. Use all the doses. Worry about it later. Use all the doses that you have and put it out the door. The other thing is from a political standpoint, you're just not going to pay a price for aiming too high versus aiming too low. I just think that is, you know, the big takeaway from the Obama years is you don't hear many people. And, you know, we had this big GameStop Reddit thing this week, which was, you know, at least by some accounts, at least partially driven by resentment and anger, where you had, you know, these millennials who witnessed their parents lose their homes or foreclosures or stock market getting away with rigging stuff. And a lot of that came from the way that the Obama administration handled the financial crisis, right? Which was better to aim too low on what we need than too high, because we don't want people coming back at us and saying you were wasteful. Let's just try and totally finesse this. And I actually think that's a charitable view on it, but that was the sort of the broad, you know, consensus. And it remains to be seen if that's what's going on here with the Biden administration and with some of the senators. But just the idea that they feel like they, even in the best case scenario, that they feel like they need to play act is still sort of disturbing, because I just don't think there's a constituency for this anymore. I think the media is okay with the Democrats going all in on this. Occasionally you'll get your New York Times writing an editorial, don't do so many executive orders. But I am willing to bet that, you know, this time next week, no one even remembers that the New York Times wrote it, never mind changed their mind about it. You know what I mean? This is a different environment. And Democrats better pick up on that quick, one way or another, it seems.
Well, I agree with you. And I hope that what we're seeing here is just some vamping, getting, you know, getting things going. You know, the it has only been a little over a week since Biden, they're still staffing up. They're trying to get things going. So, you know, this may just be a case of them just kind of vamping and hoping that they can get their, you know, get everything in order so that they can make their move. I do get the sense that they understand the urgency, particularly of COVID and the resultant economic crisis. I mean, we still had, what was it this week? I think it was 800 plus thousand new unemployment claims. I mean, that's astonishing. It's beyond belief. Yeah, 800. Yeah, I mean, it was, and last week it was 900. I mean, this is insane what's happening here, and they have to understand that. And I'm going to hope that's what's going on. But nonetheless, you know, there this idea, I think you're onto something here, and sort of questioning the idea that this unity thing, that it's really useful, or it may even be a problem, because you see the Republicans already doing this. Oh, you wanted unity, and now, you know, you're not passing our agenda. How dare you? You know, I mean, this is, and of course we knew they were going to do that because they always do. They're trolls, and that's a troll. That's saying you wanted unity, and now you're doing the things that you ran on. How dare you? And we're all supposed to sit there and make excuses and dance on the head of a pin, trying to defend the fact that they're trying to do the things they ran on, and Republicans are laughing in their faces, essentially. This is their game. They do it all the time. And the idea that they would allow them, give them any room beyond just going on Fox News and making snarky comments is probably a bad idea, because it ends up making unity a thing. And of course, you know, Biden ran on it. He did his, the inauguration was all about that, but they can frame unity. They can frame it their own way, which is, we're going to unify behind the American people. 67% of Americans want this. You know, 77% of Americans want this. That's what unity is. Unity is giving the vast majority of Americans, you know, what they voted for, what they wanted. And they don't just forget the Republicans. It's not about unity with Republicans. It's not about unity with the MAGA crowd. I mean, that's impossible. So why even put it in those terms? But, you know, we'll see. I mean, maybe this whole thing will drop out. I don't think the Republicans are going to be, you know, doing anything very, they're not going to reach their hands across the aisle. So unity's going to be a thing, not going to be, you know, literally relevant in any way.
Well, that's part of the problem, is that what should be a means to providing material benefits for the public was touted so much that it became an end. And if it becomes the end, which is unity, well, then the Republicans have a good argument. It's like, you've got to do, you said the number one, if the number one goal, primary goal, is unity, as opposed to, say, like, feed Americans, or make sure that Americans are not, you know, immiserated by job losses, or make sure that, you know, small businesses stay open, or that teachers are safe and that kids are safe. I mean, the unity is supposed to be a mechanism in which to achieve those things, as opposed to an end in and of itself. Because if it's an end in and of itself, then there's no point in even, why even have an agenda beyond that? You just capitulate so that you get unity. And that's the danger of, putting it out there and having yourself judged on unity. Now, I get the sense that that's not sticking. I think they're just like the need of the American people, and I think other, you know, those who are not in need can see it is real. And so I think that is the most compelling thing for Joe Biden to pursue. And we'll see. I mean, we have this, we have a organizing resolution that went forward at the beginning of this week because Mitch McConnell dropped his demand that Chuck Schumer's organizing resolution include, a provision to avoid the filibuster. And so we go forward. Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema basically say they're not going to in any way vote to get rid of the filibuster. And where does that leave us? The main question is, will they vote to maybe reform the filibuster if Democrats are attempting to get some legislation in place? What's your sense on that?
Well, I'm hopeful that that's what it is, that basically Mitch realized that he, they couldn't go on much longer like this, right? I mean, that was this idea that there was some, they could just refuse to organize the Senate was an untenable position. And, they were in a game of chicken, I guess, to see who was going to fold first. And my sneaking suspicion, and I have nothing to base this on, but I have to assume that this came about, Schumer just said, hey, look, Kirsten, Joe, why don't you just come out and say that you won't agree, and to get rid of the filibuster using those words, which I think were the exact words. And yep, we'll deal with this down the road as we see how this unfolds and see, how much they do end up obstructing. And of course they will. I mean, I can't imagine that even Chuck Schumer has any sort of delusion that they're going to cooperate. But it makes sense to me that they would have done that. And if Sinema, Sinema is not up for re-election until 2024. And I think Manchin also 2024, same, if I'm not mistaken. So they've got plenty of time to work this through. And, so I'm hopeful that that's what it was. Now, judging by the past, it's entirely possible that we're wrong about that, and that basically both of those people are going to stand in the way of progressive legislation. They're going to get a lot of blowback. Both of them are. It's not going to be helpful. Now, I know there's a lot of people who are worried about Manchin switching parties, which would, of course, be devastating if he were to do that. I don't think Sinema is in the same position. The Republicans in Arizona are so crazy. I don't think they'd want her. They'd probably say, no, we'd, go do something else. But there is some worry about that. But, from what I understand, I don't think Manchin sees himself in any way as a Republican. And hopefully what they've done is worked out some ideas about how they can do some reforms around the filibuster that will allow them to get around it. And as you and I discussed, I think it was last week, maybe it was the week before, there's good reasons for McConnell to want to get around the filibuster at this point, because if he does that and allows the Democrats to take those hard votes, lets Joe Manchin be the guy or Sinema and Manchin together, that lets a lot of his senators off the hook.
Yeah.
And they don't have to be the ones to have to face their voters in 2 years, which is what his big concern is. So, there are reasons why I could see, some dancing around this thing, that McConnell sees it as his benefit to keep the filibuster live, to keep that live, and also to be able to appease his, Trumpish base by saying he, that they've agreed not to do it. So anyway, well, we'll see. It's all very opaque, really, what's happening there.
I had an interesting conversation with Eric Levitz about the filibuster on the Majority Report, and he speculated that what we could see is, there's two different ways, right, in which you can reform the filibuster as opposed to getting rid of it. One is you can make the process of filibustering a little bit more onerous, and also sort of degrade how durable the filibuster is. In other words, you need to be there on 24 hours. You need to be on you need to control the Senate floor throughout the thing. You can't just call up the Senate cloakroom and say, we're going to filibuster, and then everybody says, okay. No, you actually need to, physically be there, which could make it more difficult and require more of an actual investment by senators. Or you could say, you can filibuster at 60 votes, but that's only going to slow it down 4 days. And then after that, it drops to 55. And then after that, it drops to 52, you know, that type of thing. Or the other sort of broad umbrella of filibuster reform could be akin to reconciliation, in that reconciliation is only is a 50 vote threshold that was instituted to deal with budgetary matters. Well, you could also say we're only going to have special types of bills that are going to be favored or advantaged in some fashion that have to do only with voting, let's say. So when it comes to voting rights, 51 votes will carry the day. When it comes to something else that doesn't involve, like, you know, government finances, we will allow for a reconciliation style type of vote in those instances. And Levitz's theory is that it's possible that a mansion and a cinema would be more amenable to the latter because there may be certain issues they don't want to take votes on. Joe Manchin may not want to take votes on an immigration reform bill because it's from West Virginia. People there, not so forward thinking when it comes to immigrants. Kyrsten Sinema might want to avoid taking a vote on gun control because it's Arizona and people may be a little bit less interested in gun control. So it's conceivable we could see something like that going to the Senate, where a certain category and type of bill is advantaged under Senate rules. I mean, it all remains to be seen. I feel like we have like maybe 4 or 5 weeks where we're going to really know the answer. Joe Biden's administration so far has been, you know, unleashing a lot of executive orders, which are probably not as good as they appear at first blush, but they are better than, you know, not issuing them. And they have been able to return a lot of policies that Trump sort of bastardized, if you will, to their sort of like state that they were in when Obama left office. And that's a good thing. But we've yet to really, really see how the Democrats are going to approach all of this, all of the, you know, I mean, you hear Joe Biden talking today and yesterday about the idea of, you know, nibbling away at the edges of the $1,400. And, you know, look, we have a mechanism to means test this stuff. It's called taxes.
Of course.
We can just raise taxes. You can raise taxes in reconciliation, it seems to me. Of course you can. And so if you're really worried about means testing something, which I think in the context of a pandemic seems a little bit foolish to me, but if that's really your jam, raise taxes on wealthy people and then boom, you're not letting any of these people get away with it. You know what I mean? And I don't know. I guess it just all remains to be seen. When we reconvene by March 15th, we are going to know a lot about what's going to happen, it seems to me, in the 22 election.
Oh, I agree with you. I mean, everything that's happening right now, and that's one reason why it's, you know, this is difficult. It's difficult to follow. There's a lot going on behind the scenes. We don't really know the real motives of a lot of the things other than the Republicans. I think we know their motives, right. But as far as Democrats, it's still kind of hard to tell. And whether or not there's a real game plan here, I'm not sure yet whether that there is one. It seems like there's still a lot of sort of, you know, trying to figure out as they go along. And maybe that's fine. I mean, they might be good at that. And you do need to be flexible and be able to kind of, you know, change with whatever the circumstances are. But you know, the urgency of the issues that we have on the table right now, I mean, this is unprecedented. This is like, and I think they have to view it the way that they would view it if there'd been, you know, like a 9/11 kind of thing, right? Yep. I mean, there was no pussyfooting around about that. That, you know, it was just, we're going to get in there, we're going to get this done. And they did the authorization to use military force with one dissent, you know, with Barbara Lee, the lone dissenter in California. you know, this is the, I mean, to me, you know, you've got 400,000 people dead, 430 as of today. We're looking at over 500,000 people dead and untold carnage from the disease itself, and to carnage to the healthcare system, and then all the economic suffering that's gone with it. And it's weird, the economic suffering has been so unequal. I mean,
so unequal.
People who are doing great. I mean, they're doing better than ever.
Yep.
The housing market suddenly is, you know, booming all of a sudden. Yep. And yet you've got people waiting in line for hours
for food.
For boxes full of food to feed their families. I mean, this is just really, really, this is just an unprecedented crisis, and one that they cannot play normal political games with. And you know, I just that's why the unity thing to me is frustrating, because that sort of speaks to some sort of ongoing sense that we all need to love one another, you know, and George Bush saying, you know, I think everybody ought to love their neighbor like they'd like to be loved themselves. You know, he said it, and I'm kind of like, that's nice. But you know what? Look at, go take care of your people, George. Okay.
Exactly.
Cause you just don't have a chat with them. Cause I don't really want to hear that, but you know, this is, and I get it. We all need to, you know, it'd be much better if the country could come to consensus and we could all not, this great hostility would not be there. But right now we've got 430,000 dead people. We've got bodies. And you know, that is a long-term crisis, cultural crisis that, you know, we can try and deal with. But right now this thing has to get done. So that's a little, I'm starting to get a little frustrated, I guess. And I probably shouldn't belabor that, but it is sort of bothering me a bit that, you know, we just don't have time.
I agree. And I think the healthiest thing I can say about, or the most optimistic thing I can say about this administration so far, and it's not to take away, there's been, like I say, a bunch of executive orders that some are more substantive than others, but in terms of where they're pointing are very good. And some of the federal, the cabinet picks and some of the other picks that Joe Biden has done have been good. He is definitely seems to be aware and cautious of making appointments or decisions that are going to, you know, essentially trigger the left in many respects. And I say that in the best way. And so there are some positives here, but the biggest positive is just that I feel like the left of the Democratic Party, and maybe, you know, the center left of the Democratic Party, even, they're on top of this in a way that, you know, no one was in Barack Obama's election. And I think that's, and, you know, as we've been saying from the very beginning about Joe Biden, of all the presidents that you could get who might be responsive to that type of pressure and skepticism, Joe Biden, he's my second favorite type of president. I just keep saying this, he's a cipher. And so, if you can't get the person you like in terms of ideology, get somebody who is conceivably could be pushed, not to share your ideology, but could be pushed by that ideology. And I think that's happening with Joe Biden. I guess just a matter of time. We're going to have to wait and see what happens in the Senate. We're going to have to wait and see what Joe Biden pushes for. And until that time, we will talk again next week. We will be very close. I guess we're still about a week and a half away from the launch of the impeachment hearings, but I have a feeling those could be more consequential than the last time around.
And I hope so.
Me too. All right. Well, Heather, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Heather Parton is a weekly contributor to Ring of Fire Radio. You can find her writings over at Salon.com and her popular blog, Hullabaloo. Now I'm going to hand the show over to our new Ring of Fire co-host, Emma Vigeland. Emma?
Hey, everyone. I'm here with the great Ken Klippenstein, who is now an investigative reporter over at The Intercept. You were at The Nation. You were at TYT before. We were co-workers. Famous, wonderful person on the internet. How are you doing, Ken?
Well, now we're competitors, so I don't know how friendly I'll be, but I'm ready for the debate here.
Okay, well, I will bring down the hammer and critique your reporting. You just fell into my trap. So Ken's latest piece for The Intercept had to do with the failed Capitol insurrection entitled Defense Department Anticipate the Election-Related Unrest Before Capitol Riot, which, you know, that was some days ago when you wrote this, but I want to have you on to break it down because obviously those events are going to be so central to the upcoming impeachment trial. Now, yesterday, we're recording this on Wednesday, the Republicans the Republicans voted 45-55 to Rand Paul's failed motion on impeachment, basically signaling that they're not going to convict. But at the same time, just for the history books, this does have a lot of ramifications. Can you talk about your piece and how the Defense Department, despite having the biggest budget in the world, blank checks from Congress, how they were alerted to this potential threat and seemed not to act in the slightest?
Yeah, I thought that this story was instructive of how these, intelligence and national security bodies tend to work in that if their intelligence finds something that they don't like, they're very good at covering that up or hiding it or not disclosing it to the public. So, take us back to when the insurrection happened. Initially, the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, all these different agencies, they were saying, oh, we didn't know. We didn't have any intelligence about it. How were we supposed to know? I thought that was ludicrous because they watch, as you say, they have all of these resources. I mean, we have this sprawling post 9/11 infrastructure that exists. It was already the biggest in the world prior to that, but it's been supercharged since 9/11. So I found it very hard to believe. In addition to just talking to folks inside, the notion that they wouldn't have picked up on something that wasn't even hidden. They weren't particularly secretive about it. These, far right groups that were going here, they were openly advertising it. So I thought that was implausible. So I started asking some of my friends in the military if that's the case. And one of them says, oh, yeah, we had a report. And what that report showed, it was from it was a Navy report that anticipated it was the specificity of this report is amazing. They didn't just anticipate unrest related to the election. I had already reported on that. They anticipated unrest related to specifically people that didn't think the results of the election were legitimate. Which, shocker, if you have a president going on national TV and telling everyone the election was stolen, some people might have feelings about that. They maybe are going to be unhappy about that, and the percentage of them might act on those feelings. And that's what happened. That's what the Navy knew was going to happen, not just, from these far right groups. They mentioned QAnon. This was they thought that there was going to be unrest in the intervening period between the election and the inauguration. And they knew that it was likely to take place, likely to affect the D.C. area where all the federal buildings were located. And lo and behold, that's what happened. They knew all of it. And the military, they really were the institution, I think, here that could have acted to do something in terms of sending in. They could have sent in National Guardsmen. That was their prerogative to do. And I think more than any other agency, they were the ones that needed to go in there. And they didn't. So. The question then is why is that? Why wasn't this report heeded? And that's sort of what I explained in the story.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I might ask you to speculate just because to the best of your ability, this could be a politicization of some of these decisions, or it could just be like, which I think is probably the most likely scenario, an underestimation of people based on pre-existing notions in people's minds and what constitutes a threat and what doesn't. I mean, what if it was some sort of top-down conspiracy, we might know by now, but the failure can still be as egregious even if it wasn't like Trump dictating ignore this, etc.
Yeah, so initially I thought it was the latter. I thought it was, these are folks that don't fit a sort of like Hollywood image of what terrorists are, and just to be frank, I thought there were going to be a lot of kind of racial overtones, just sort of police looking at, a group of mostly white people and thinking, oh, okay, how bad this is going to be. But when I look at that report, it was interesting. They listed QAnon, 5G truthers, a lot of these very specific types of groups. They characterized them as terror threats. So they seem to be perfectly clear-eyed about the threat posed by these types of groups. And so I think it was less that, at least at the administrative or intelligence level, I think it was more, look at what the head of the Capitol Police tasked with protecting, the U.S. Capitol, the Congress, what he said. And I think it was the Washington Post, they reported that he initially did not want to request National Guard because of, quote, what he called, quote, optics concerns, the optics of having the military standing there next to all these, frankly, Trump supporters. And so I would say that it was political in nature, but I have to be honest, maybe I spent too much time talking to these guys, but I sort of sympathize with them because, you know, I talk to these guys and they tell me, okay, look, so we call the National Guard. There's all these police standing around. What do you think Trump is going to do when he sees that kind of an image? Well, he's probably going to have a meltdown and tweet, you know, the Capitol Police don't care about you. And they're, you know, throwing the government, they're throwing us to the wolves or something. And then the guy gets fired. I mean, Trump has spent 4 years. Obviously, I wish that the Capitol, you know, police chief had stood up to him and said, no, we're going to call in the National Guard regardless. And I don't care what the political consequences may be. But in the real world, that's not how people get to the top of these agencies. They get to the top of agencies by knowing who's in charge and how to, you know, they know what side their bread's buttered on. They know what the guys that, you know, are at the tops of these agencies are going to, what's going to make them upset. And so I would guess that it was just self-preservation on the part of a lot of these agency chiefs, not wanting to enrage Trump with the image of, you know, you send in National Guard, there's going to be scuffles, there's going to be, you know, imagery showing a sort of conflict of some nature generally. And so I think the buck really stops at Trump. I mean, there were failures all around. You know, the intelligence should have been heeded. But at the end of the day, if the president doesn't want something to happen, and he was very clearly in support of these demonstrators, in the real world, that's going to put, you know, people in these agencies under a lot of pressure to treat it with kid gloves. And so I think that's what happened.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking, obviously. I think there's the critique is extremely valid. But for personalities and people, it's very easy to cast judgment when you weren't there. And a lot of the times people are just responding to human incentives and structures within their right. own just personal lives and not a part of some Machiavellian plot, which I feel like a lot of people underestimate that dynamic. But just talking about the insurrection and the role of policing there, well, one, I have two questions. One, that there seemed to have been a lot of off-duty cops who were a part of the insurrection attempt. So what your thoughts are on that? And then secondly, the response to what we've seen has been from centrist, center-left politicians, a desire to write new laws surrounding domestic terror as if there aren't enough terrorism laws at our disposal. So if one, you can first touch on the role of off-duty police officers in the insurrection, which I know it has been instrumental in your reporting, that knowledge, and also just the fallout and the potential legislative consequences of what happened on January 6th.
Yeah. So the notion that within law enforcement, there are Trump supporters themselves and, you know, specifically even people that are sympathetic to some of the stuff that we saw happen in the Capitol, 100% true. I don't dispute that at all. Just by way of example, at the Department of Homeland Security, there are offices where they're playing One America News Network, like in the workplace. I know that they're based on, you know, people that I've worked with and, you know, I've reported stories about over the last 4 years. I know that there are QAnon supporters in surprisingly, you know, high levels of law enforcement. I don't mean to suggest that that's the majority by any means, but it's also not it's not insignificant. You know, that's a presence. That's 100% true. And I also know that the FBI is looking at this. They're conducting what's called an insider threat investigation. That's when they're concerned that other people that have security clearances pose a threat because they believe they hold, you know, ideologies that may compel them to give up the secrets of these agencies, which is always like one of the chief concerns. But also it's embarrassing if, you know, one of their people is implicated in something. So that's not just something that, you know, we can see publicly and think, but that's something the FBI thinks as well and that they're looking at. I think there's going to be, as was the case, you know, with responding to the insurrection of the Capitol, there's going to be a lot of politics involved. I'm, you know, cynical. I talk to guys in the FBI who say, who are likewise cynical about the likelihood that, you know, if they're able to find anything that goes really high up the food chain, that they're going to be able to do a whole lot about it because the power is going to look after itself and try to defend itself. So, you know, that's hard, but, you know, there are members in the military. I was talking to somebody in military counterintelligence, that was, you know, saying that there are, you know, ongoing concerns about exactly all of this kind of stuff. You've got young men that are sort of confused and that's just sort of the, you know, perfect conditions for, you know, falling into this type of extremism. So all of that is totally true. I just don't think that that was the, how should I say, like overweening factor or the necessarily like
the driving force the main, behind.
Yeah, it was certainly an ambient condition. Yeah. Definitely, yeah. You have a picture, and people have been put on leave among Capitol Police for taking photos with the protesters and letting them in, that kind of stuff. I will say, I know someone very high up in the FBI who was telling me that they did have concerns that individuals that got in there were able to locate secure facilities where they were being
unpacked, and that's obviously the most frightening thing about it, where they were
right,
like, and they're in here, this is the right hallway in the Capitol building where we could find Pelosi, etc.
But my impression, and I don't know this well enough to report it, but my impression for the time being is that the best information I have now is that that wasn't necessarily police, that may have been a member of Congress is what they're looking at and worried about, that was because they would have information about where these different facilities are located. And so there's a lot of anxiety. When I first heard this, it sounded sort of like liberal fanfic kind of stuff. So I thought I was a little I wasn't saying it was impossible. But I was a little skeptical that someone was going to risk their career by giving someone a knowledge of where they're, hiding members and things. It just sounded so off the wall. But as you've said, the reporting is, at least borne out. I think that the notion that this is a credible concern. And moreover, what I'm told is that people went straight to these facilities. And it's not like I figured, I report on Congress a lot. I sort of learned the facilities is a huge place. It's way too big to just sort of stumble on something, which is what I thought happened. No, apparently they went straight to it. So the question is, how do they know to go straight to it? And that's something that the investigations will have to unpack. But that's certainly an ambient concern, sympathies among law enforcement. But I think it's exactly that, a sort of tertiary matter, at least with respect to what happened at the Capitol.
Or just a separate matter, right, of white supremacy and of conspiracy peddling that's in policing that may not have directly implicated the actual confluence of events that happened at the Capitol.
Exactly.
And then, yes, just my second question about your thoughts on any heat surrounding these potential new domestic terror laws resulting from this, because obviously I'll editorialize here and say it's like one of the worst ideas I've ever heard. Hillary Clinton floating it on her podcast, and Nancy Pelosi, Joe Biden floating it publicly. The exact kind of idiotic response of giving more power to institutions that already have too much power. That's my opinion. What's your sense of how that could break down?
It's funny you brought this up. I'm in the middle. This is my next story. What I'm finding talking to countless folks in Homeland Security and FBI, other DOJ components, is a lot more dissension within the ranks on this issue than you might think. You would think that law enforcement, they're being offered a new authority. They're like, great, yeah, we love this. That's not what I'm hearing. I mean, I don't want to be misleading. That's certainly a view that is commonly propounded when I talk to folks in law enforcement about this kind of thing. But it's far from, I would say, the majoritarian impulse or by any means the a consensus. And it doesn't really cuts across both political ideologies too. I have conservatives saying they think it's a bad idea. I have liberals saying it's a bad idea, as well as both tendencies saying that they think it's a good idea. So I'll kind of lay out what I'm being told. I don't think people realize what it means. So we already have a domestic terror law on the books, or we have a terrorism law on the books. It's just that the nature of those statutes requires law enforcement to prove that there's some foreign nexus to it. So in order to treat someone as a terrorist, they only designate foreign groups terrorists. So Al-Qaeda, ISIS, these kind of things. So that the law enforcement, if they want to be able to bring the hammer down on you in that regard, they have to be able to show that you're getting some kind of material support from ISIS or direction from Al-Qaeda or whatever it may be. So when we're debating this, we're not really saying creating a terror law because it already exists. They're saying they want to strip that requirement that there be some foreign nexus. So then they can label domestic groups this without any sort of evidence that there's some kind of foreign group directing you. And what I'm hearing is that that's not just a nightmare for civil liberties, that may cause a lot of headaches for law enforcement as well, because what ends up happening is there's just the whole process of frankly due process of getting a judge to sign off on a warrant. I was talking to a guy in the FBI who was telling me that you could get something called administrative subpoenas, kind of fancy word for that. You don't have to go to a judge anymore, you can just get one. Right. It's really scary stuff. Another example is another concern someone else raised. And again, these are not progressives by any means. A lot of folks in the intelligence and law enforcement communities, they tend to be conservative, if anything, probably a lot of sort of centrists. But another guy told me, he said there's a question of material support. So, for example, if you have an uncle that believes in Q stuff and Q is labeled a terrorist organization, say you have him over for dinner, or say you loan him some money, say you help them with something. Any of that in theory could be construed as material support for terrorism. I'm not necessarily saying that's how it's going to be executed, but this opens up all sorts of doors, the likes of which I don't think people really ordinary people really understand when they just hear the word terror designation.
Or just, I mean, I appreciate the example of QAnon, but when have our agencies used their indiscriminate power against leftist organizations in history? Oh, right.
Oh,
all
never.
The time.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, obviously, most infamously, the FBI was out of control when targeting the civil rights movement and Martin Luther King Jr., most infamously as well. I obviously foresee a future, if this was to come to pass, in which left-wing groups would be the first groups targeted, even more so than groups like QAnon, because that tends to be, and you can affirm this statement, I guess, the focus of these agencies like the FBI and the CIA, more so, or the FBI is domestic, but you know what I mean, more so than is proportionate, I guess, to the amount of harm they inflict on American society.
Well, these agencies are so big, and it's changed so much just in the last 10 years. So what might have been the province of the FBI, if you open up this terror designation, maybe DHS would be able to handle it. And DHS is a sprawling, this is the biggest law enforcement agency in the country. If you look at the, the number of Border Patrol agents, I think, is greater than the number of FBI agents. So when we think of the FBI, that's a much smaller thing. So these are the guys they're sending to, ICE, Customs and Border Protection, Border Patrol. These are the guys they're sending to Portland and things that, are generating a whole lot of negative press, not just for them, but I think for the country, people watching this overseas, this is sort of crazy. Well, those resources are going to be brought to bear in a way that people can't even imagine. I mean, the gloves get taken off. I was talking to an intelligence officer who works at Homeland Security. He was very excited about the idea. And I asked him, so why do you like this idea of the terror designation? He's like, ooh, the gloves really come off. And I'm paraphrasing, but he says, we can do all kinds of electronic surveillance that we're not allowed to do. And I was like, what's that? He starts talking about, it was called like Title IX. It's for wiretaps and those kinds of things. He's like, you got a terror group, all that stuff goes out the window. And he was really excited about what he'd be able to see. And it was sort of, I like the guy on a personal level. I don't know if I agree with him politically, but just hearing, it was like he was licking his chops thinking about how much more they were going to get to pour over if this ends up passing. And I think that, frankly, is what would come to pass. Because he told me, he's like, there's so many times where we get to someone, it's like, oh, I'd love to see what that person's up to, but we just can't because they're what's called a U.S. person. People on U.S. soil enjoy certain protections. You have to get a FISA warrant, things like that.
Which, by the way, the viewers and listeners should know, a FISA warrant is quite easy to get by when you are asking some judges, right? Like there were reports from the Bush era, was it the Bush era when they were just basically handing them out like hotcakes? I mean, sorry, this was under Obama when FISA warrants came to pass, right?
My impression is they've never been extremely common. But anytime they ask for it, almost every time they get
yes,
it.
Yes,
so the vast, it's like over 90% are approved. There's not a ton, there's maybe a couple thousand each year. And from folks I talk to in the community, I think a lot of that is probably going to be like, Russian intelligence officials they're following or heads of state or heads of big corporations. I'm not saying they don't abuse it, but it's just not used very much. If you change a law like this, I think you're going to see those numbers increase dramatically. And as you point out, to the extent that they grant these things, it's sort of a rubber stamping institution. They just grant every request that's given. So my impression is that they're just, fortunately, there's a limited number of requests, but that's what I'd be concerned about changing under any sort of adjustment to our legal framework for terrorism.
Yeah. And lastly, Ken, I know you have to go. You're a busy, busy man. Would you agree with that characterization?
Yes. If my editor is listening, yes, I do
yes,
agree with that characterization.
Ken never sleeps. What do you foresee in terms of how the events of January 6th, how just the aftershock of the Trump administration, how that's going to affect the structure of national security agencies and I guess federal law enforcement agencies under Biden? What will 2021 look like in terms of the targets of your reporting and your expertise?
Yeah, anytime you have an event like this, I think there are legitimate security concerns that justify some kind of a response. On the other hand, we have a kind of stormtrooper army of troops in front of the, and it's kind of like, I talk to guys outside and say, how useful is that to just have this huge kind of like cavalcade of just these warriors standing there. They're like, it's security theater. They got embarrassed because they missed the other thing. So now they've got to do some big show of force. And, you know, Congress is going to decide funding and these kinds of events get people to think, oh, this is good. We want this kind of stuff. So there's a lot of optics and kind of theater that's going around that's going on, I think. That being said, I'm not saying it doesn't justify a law enforcement response, but talking to if you talk to the guys, the heads of the agency who get the most face time on cable news and that kind of thing, they'll say we need more funding, we need more research, all these things. You talk to the rank and file guys that are actually doing the work of, you know, putting cuffs on terror suspects or, you know, monitoring that kind of thing. They have a much different picture. They tend I don't want to suggest that they're against funding, but their focus seems to be more, let's use the resources we have in a more sensible fashion. So my understanding is that they're sort of locked in a post 9/11 counterterror framework where they're still given this sort of structural design to focus on foreign groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS, where without changing the terror laws, they could focus. So I'll give you an example. The Department of Homeland Security, after Trump was inaugurated in 2017, he dissolved the domestic extremism branch, which was designed to handle exactly these types of threats.
Which was already pretty threadbare, by my understanding, right, compared to the right international Muslim terror threats.
Right. 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 And so that's what I'm hearing, is they just want to readjust. And even completely aside from the, do we want a terrorism or do we want more sort of legal authorities? This impression that let's just, you know, focus what we have so far on what we need to, like, I'll give you an example. An intelligence officer was telling me after Trump came into office, he had been, you know, monitoring all these foreign threats. Next thing he's doing is looking at students overstaying their visas. And he was just so angry about that because, maybe I don't agree with him politically on things, but it's like he views his role as, you know, protecting the country from pretty serious threats, cartels, terrorism, narco trafficking, that kind of thing. And suddenly he's watching this absolutely ridiculous penny ante sort of just Trumpy kind of stuff. And it's like, why do I have a top secret security clearance to watch some kid from the UK who overstayed his visa by 2 weeks? This is ludicrous. So maybe less of that. and that, you know, I mean, you could probably just shuffle resources around and improve things without even changing the sort of gross sum of money that we're giving them.
All right. Well, I mean, I guess that's something, right? My editorial position is just like, I don't think Biden is somebody who has a strong ideology. So it's going to be a long process to just pushing him in a direction that's more progressive. And like he likes to, Sam says this all the time, and it's so right, place himself at the center of where the Democratic Party network is at a current political moment in history. And so as long as that point is a little bit in a direction that leans more just, we should have some improvement here. But Ken Klippenstein, investigative reporter at The Intercept, thank you so much, Ken, and obviously follow him on Twitter. Good friend. Ken's the best. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for another week of Ring of Fire. Hey, are you still subscribed to the free show? Come on, head over to ROFpodcast.com. Support the show by becoming a member. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. But becoming a member at ROFpodcast.com is the way that you can ensure this show keeps on running. Check out my daily show, Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream covering all the biggest news stories of the day. For Emma Vigeland, Heather Parton, I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.
When the deadness in your eye, flash your flesh, desperate for it.